Chance Madison over it. It is Madison! And he's done it! A phenomenal free kick from James Madison!
So hello and welcome to the latest By the Minute Aberdeen podcast. Now to mark us reaching the cup final, we thought we'd really push the boat out on our guests this week. Well, on two of them anyway, because Martin Clunas is still with us. Hi Martin.
How you doing, Richard?
Yes, I'm sorry you didn't get the big intro, but we do welcome back former Dons keeper, that columnist on the game, and an essential Twitter follow, and basically all-round suave bastard, David Preece. How are you, David?
I'm very well, good evening.
Good evening. And finally, product of Mackie Academy, another man who is returning to this show to sprinkle some professionalism on us. It's Sunday Times football writer and author of the recently released Fearless, a book on Leicester's success last season. It's Jonathan Northcroft. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello there. Not suave, though.
Sorry, Jonathan, you didn't get that.
No, again. It's okay. Some people are, some people aren't.
I need to clear these in advance, I think, in future to make sure that there's no rivalry develops. We'll start with the game on Saturday, the League Cup semi-final against Morton. It was a potential banana skin, obviously. But, Martin, we did make a positive start. Had everything but the goal in those first 10 minutes. And it did seem, at that point, a matter of when, not if, we'd make the breakthrough.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the first 10 minutes were brilliant, really. We're facing down the barrel of maybe winning 4 or 5-0 and lots of chances, lots of corners. I think there was 11 corners that ended up being in the first half. You know, you kind of worry at half-time that, you know, we didn't capitalise on it. The opening spell was great. I thought the first 45 minutes we completely dominated, bar that one breakaway chance that Katongo had, which was obviously saved by Joe Lewis. We didn't capitalise, but we know we got there in the end. There was like genuine movement, genuine width on that pitch as well. It's obviously, we all talk about how Hampden's a big pitch, and we completely capitalised on that. I think that we totally outplayed Morton.
However, fair to say that the best chance of that first half fell to Jake Katongo from a mistake by Mark Reynolds. He and Anthony O'Connor seemed ill at ease with Katongo's pace and power for most of the game. Now, Jai had a spell up here at Pittodrie. Attitude issues seemed to contribute to him being shown the door after 6 months, but he seems to have screwed the knot and certainly played pretty well on Saturday without necessarily looking like scoring beyond that chance in the first half. What did you make of him, Jonathan?
Yeah, he looked like he enjoyed the spaces and the freedom and one of those players he probably prefers playing by himself than with a partner. I was impressed with him. He's got a bit of strength, a bit of everything. When you sort of you fit his touch is probably slightly better than it looks initially. It did take really good work by Joe Lewis to sort of face him down and save those couple of chances that he had. But I did think he was, you know, I thought the one real weakness for the Dons was the disconnect at centre-back. I just didn't think that O'Connor and Reynolds really were on a wavelength. You could see that they hadn't been playing too much together. And there was a bit of uncertainty there whenever the ball was played behind them, coupled with you know, I like the midfield balance going forward with Shinny and McLean, but neither of them are inclined to defend as well. So there was a little bit of a weak sort of soft centre that Morton and Katongo exploited at times. And thank goodness for Joe Lewis in those moments.
Well, David, you were on Twitter during the game, and certainly you made your feelings known that O'Connor and Reynolds didn't seem to be working during that first half. And obviously, we did actually change to a three at the back for the start of the second. But these are not guys who are just pitched together for the first time on Saturday. It's a bit worrying that 3 months into the season, a season which started, in fact, back in June, we're still having these issues with two of the regulars.
Well, that's it. I mean, I think somebody mentioned tonight on Twitter's question about Derek McInnes unwilling to change things when it's not working. Well, Saturday was a perfect example when he did do that. I think he got it absolutely spot on from his point of view. That's great. And it allowed Morton to come on to us a little bit more. Say, oh, Aberdeen, yeah. and made more space for to play and eventually get that goal. But I think from the two central defenders, I think, on, like you said, you've sitting on a big pitch like that, Katongo with a lot of pace. They were Dyson with death really playing so high because Aberdeen had a lot of the ball. Whenever Morton won the ball, they were always going to look to fire a quick ball forwards and get Katongo in behind, leaving a hell of a lot of space there. And the back four, it was just, it was almost like a ECG graph. You know, it was, it really was bad defending. And I couldn't believe for the life of me why the two of them, they knew that he's quick, they knew what his danger was, yet both of them were just really high and sort of invited onto themselves. And it's okay. I mean, I think it's quite, sometimes we've left themselves 2-on-2, and I don't mind that because if you're going to be attacking, you're going to be positive. Your two full-backs can be a little bit high, and you can say to yourself, yeah, we trust ourselves, we back ourselves to go 2-on-2, but not if they're both going to go tight with the men. That, you know, there's got to be some sort of communication there. So if one moves in, the other one drops back, and they got away with it.
Let's talk a little bit more about the one incident where we really did get away with it. And Joe Lewis obviously saved the bacon on Mark Reynolds, who's miscontrolled let Jai Katongo in just before half time on Saturday. He's very fast off his line. I don't think it's a brilliant finish, effort or a finish from Katongo David, but he doesn't go down quickly. He does all the things which, you know, the textbooks would tell him to do, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. He was just patient, and then when the time come, he spread himself as much as he can, and sometimes you feed to your friends in them situations. But I think Chris Sutton probably said at the time that he should have lifted the ball over him, and once he got that close to him, I think that would have been the right option. But he's Joe's done really well. I've been impressed with him. You know, I've seen a lot of him since from his time when he was at Peterborough. And, you know, he had a lot of potential. There was, you know, people were expecting a lot of big things from him. He just hasn't quite fulfilled that potential. And he went away to Cardiff, didn't really play many games there. And probably had to take a bit of a gamble going to Blackpool just to play some games. And eventually it's worked out for him because I think he's a decent age now. And he's on a great stage at Aberdeen to prove himself and show what he can do. And I think... it's been a big improvement this season after the loss of Danny Ward last year, obviously.
He, like yourself, was number two for a long spell at Cardiff, and obviously, as a reserve keeper, you don't get the same opportunities to make an impression off the bench as you might do if you have a squad player outfield. How frustrating a position can it be?
Oh, it's very frustrating, but I think there's no point you getting yourself down about it and looking at the situation negatively. I think what he's done is, when he went to when he was at Peterborough, you know, like I said, there was big things expected of him, and he just didn't quite have that consistency. You know, he'd have a lot of good games, and then he'd make a mistake, and it seemed to affect him, especially towards the end of his time at Peterborough. Going to Cardiff, I think he's. You know, he was behind David Marshall, who had a brilliant time at Cardiff. And sometimes in situations like that, you know, you maybe come off the back of a not so good spell, but it gives you a chance just to step out the limelight and then work on your game and give yourself however long it takes. I mean, hopefully it doesn't take too long. But if you give yourself at least a year out of the limelight as number two, gives you a chance to work on your game and train, change things, work on things in games that are more or less meaningless in the under-23s or in reserve team football, and then come back stronger for it. I think the time that Joe spent out the first team, I think it's probably done him a world of good in the long term, really.
And were you actually a little bit surprised that we were able to lure him north? I mean, obviously, as you say, he's had to maybe take a gamble on his career coming here, but... He still seems like someone who would have had a half-decent reputation based on that time at Peterborough, based on his being called up to the England squad at that age. It seemed like a little bit of a coup, certainly the upper limit of our transfer ambitions, I would have said.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a great signing. I was really interested to see how he would do. But I think, like I said, you know, he'd been at Blackpool, whereas, you know, things weren't at all stable there. And I think that he took a huge chance going there because it could have went massively wrong for him and it could have just eaten into his career and perhaps, you know, been the end of him a little bit. But he's went there and he's worked hard and he played well. He had a great time at Blackpool. I think that when he's... It's probably the status of the club now. You look at Aberdeen now, and it's over the last two or three seasons, especially since Derek's took over. You know, the club's got a high profile because of its history, but in the last two or three years, it's lifted again. The club and the team have become contenders again, and that's probably helped. You know, that the cup win 2 years ago, things like that will help luring players like him to the club. And hopefully that'll keep continuing. I mean, you look at the front four that they've got now. I know James Maddison's on loan, but if you look at that front four, Rooney, McGinn and Hayes at left, and Maddison sitting behind there, that is a great front four. And I think that's probably why it's so disappointing that with the result tonight, because I think just as the last two seasons, there's a great chance this year.
Martin, we played a very slow... We did the usual thing on a Derek McKenna, so a very slow tempo build-up. Derek does like to emphasise patience in these situations, holding on to the ball, recycling possession. But a failure to move the ball around at any kind of pace on Saturday really frustrated me at times. Against a 10-man defence, it seems like you're asking for trouble.
It does, yeah. I mean, I think we had something... It was just over 60% possession as well, which... It's that slow build-up, it's that just keep the ball, look for the opening. I mean, I think, though, at times it looked like they were playing, you know, five or six at the back, which doesn't obviously leave a lot of gaps, but big pitch, talented players, you know, we really should be looking to kind of cut them open a bit better than we did. I understand that you desperately don't want to, like, concede one on the counter. That would have been absolute hell if that happened. It would have been hell to pay, and I think the crowd would have probably got on the players' backs, and it's the last thing we need. I'm elated that we're in the final, and it feels wrong to somehow be, like, to be nitpicking that. You know, it does feel, like, terrible. It's like, why are we nitpicking here? But it just, there was points in the second half where the crowd were really on the players' backs just before the first goal. And I think the frustration was coming from the stands as well, that, you know, the ball's isn't being moved quick enough. You know, we could be exploiting these players. All due respect to Martin, you know, they came with a game plan. You know, they played like a very typical Jim Duffy team. You know, their goalkeeper was time-wasting from minute five. You know, it was obvious what their game plan was. You've got a team with McGinn, you've got a team with James Maddison, you've got a team with Johnny Hayes in it. We should be looking to move the ball really quickly, exploit their fullbacks, exploit their centre-halves, and we just didn't really, really get that going.
David, I'll come at you on this again. The goal actually came at the point where Morton were perhaps probably sensing we could actually get something concrete out of this. Do sides maybe start to forget about the game plan when they get a whiff of that?
Like I said earlier, I think it's down to Derek's decision to go to three at the back. I think it was sort of... With the four that we were holding the high line, very high line, and so that sort of forces Morton back anyway. Going to three at the back, it just opened the pitch up a little bit more and invited them on. It was sort of, maybe it's not rubber door, but it was sort of like saying, well, yeah, we'll give you a little bit more respect and we'll give them a little bit more of the ball and take a chance that they won't do anything with it. So it just opens the pitch up and we can do it. When now he's got into the box set and he's done the best thing as well. He's, you know, in that situation, he's been patient. He didn't go for goal. He's trying to just put it across the keeper and we've getting the tap in. I think that's what we've just been saying before about the slow build up. You've got to give respect to Morton. Morton, you know, it's all right complaining about, oh, we should be doing this, and or the fans complain that we should be moving the ball and quickly. But you've got to give respect to the other team, and Morton defended really well. Every time I'm watching Aberdeen, all I'm wanting, every time somebody gets the ball, I just want them to give the ball to Johnny Hayes. That's all I want. I'm a massive fan of this. So every time I'm watching the TV, getting to watch the games, like the Rangers game is a perfect example of that. Just want somebody to get the ball and just ping it out to him. Because the sooner he gets the ball and he can get somebody 1v1, I'll back him every day of the week. you're right what you said, though, that it was a little bit slow in the build-up. They got behind the ball very quickly, and by the time the ball was out with Johnny, there was two, sometimes three players around him. And I think they made a real conscious effort to, when the ball got out to him, that everyone got round the ball.
As well as, obviously, keeping men behind the ball, Morton did employ that footballing zeitgeist to the high press for most of the afternoon, Jonathan. Now, it's draining for most sides. Tottenham Man City, earlier this season, where Pochettino basically set his sides out to do a very high press and made the substitutes at 65 minutes quite early because he knew that players would be exhausted from playing this. Now, it's draining for most sides to do that, doubly so on a pitch like Hampden, for a team like Morton, used to playing at a lower tempo. Once that first goal went in, the game did seem over, didn't it?
Oh, it did. We've talked about their one sort of game plan in terms of creating chances, which was the ball through the middle for Katongo. I mean, the high press is so much in vogue here. I guess across European football, but it seems to really have sort of been what everyone's talking about in the Premier League this year with the arrival of Guardiola, who likes his high press. Klopp's taken Liverpool to new levels and that, and Pochettino's been doing it for a while. Morton had the youth in their team to do that. I think they had a young team who had plenty of energy. But when you to do that for 90 minutes, you need to be pretty savvy as well, and they probably didn't quite have the sort of smarts to do it for the entire game. And I agree with David that the thing I really needed to do was release the wide players quickly, release Johnny Hayes in particular. I thought key to that was actually in the first half, Maddison getting on the ball with that great ability to shake off a man and ping diagonal balls out to either wing. He was getting on the ball a lot less as the game went on, which was a problem. Really, what you got to do with that high press is just cut it out. Play quick, fairly. Not direct, not long balls, but direct, good passes to beat the press. Which in the end, it came. I thought the change of formation was influential as well because it let Kenny McLean get a bit forward a lot quicker. Which was important, but I don't know how much was due to that thing that a team faces when it has a great start to a game and it doesn't score a goal. I think that's a problem for any team psychologically. I'm sure David's played in plenty of games like that it really deflates a side and it gives the opposition a boost. I did think that was a factor as well, and actually, to put a positive spin on it, the fact that Aberdeen came through it was a lot of progress from what we've seen in previous recent Hampden appearances. So it was a bit of an ordeal at times that at least the best you can say is they passed it. They solved the problem in the end. I guess that's what the game looked like to me. And in the end, manager and players managed to solve the problem.
I think that's an important point actually to make, because for all that it was 0-0 for a long time, for all that Morton did have the best chance of the opening 60 minutes, let's say, I never felt that uncomfortable, which, given that I was sitting inside Hampden, a place which has made me feel nothing but discomfort over the past 15 years, was quite surprising. So it was, I think, a controlled performance. Even during that 5-10 minutes, well, Morton were always going to have a point in the game in which they were going to exert some concentrated pressure. And yeah, I just kind of wonder whether that played into the mentality a little bit, and we just happened to get the opening goal just at that point. So it was a job done, basically, afternoon, and good to walk out of that stadium feeling not suicidal for the first time in seven visits, in fact. So that's two cup finals into Derek McInnes's fourth season that we've reached under Derek, where obviously his league performances have been very solid, very strong, done exactly what we would hope that he would do when he was appointed. But clearly it's an improvement on past managers, but given our budget, given the circumstances at other clubs right now, is this an acceptable return for a club of our size, Martin?
I think it is. I mean, we would like to. I mean, there's been disappointments in the cups, yeah. I mean, but we look at it in terms of league form, and we are we are the second best team in the country. There's no getting away from that. No, I'm sure that there are people on Twitter and social media who will argue about the club that were just promoted from the Championship this season, but statistically, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, in terms of ability, we're the second best team in the country. We've perhaps maybe underperformed in the Cups, but we've been underperforming in the Cups for a long time now. You know, like all Aberdeen managers, because the league is such a big ask with the financial differences that you will be judged in the Cups. The Cups have become such a crapshoot over the past 4 or 5 seasons, and it's been won by so many different teams that it's kind of hard to pin down. Obviously disappointed that we've not reached more cup finals, but you know, we've slipped here and there. There's been less embarrassing exits to lower league teams, which is something that's always going to get Derek a little bit of credit. I would obviously like to see more cup finals. I think, you know, we're at one. There's still another cup to go this season as well. If we get to two cup finals in a season, does that change his record and say he's a success in the cups? For me, it probably would. I mean, no, we've got 30 days or whatever it is to the cup final, and you know, if we win that, then Derek will be seen as a success.
Jonathan, is this just a case of the whinging football fan always wanting more?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, Aberdeen are the second best team in Scotland. I think Celtic know that as well. I know someone on the staff there, who said to me a couple of weeks ago after the Old Firm league game, you know, there's a massive gulf between Aberdeen and Rangers in terms of the challenge they pose Celtic, and you know, I think they see Aberdeen as the second best team. So, you know, I suppose being in a cup final, when you look at it like that, is par for the course. And I think it's right for us to expect that to be a semi-regular occurrence. And I was cheered to see the manager talk about that as well. Not sort of go over the boat, over the top celebrating getting to a cup final, but suggesting that, you know, what Aberdeen need is an era where that becomes a norm. That's exactly the right way to look at it. And, you know, I'd say there's still a little bit of a gap between Aberdeen and Rangers at the moment. So, you know, while that exists, you know, they may try and close it financially, but while that exists, then absolutely, this is the time to be getting in cup finals, you know, winning more of them, and with, you know, a team now with, you know, several young players who should be getting, you know, if they can get used to this type of thing, then I actually thought when we won the League Cup, there was a big opportunity missed not to then go ahead and win or at least get in the final for the Scottish Cup. I thought that was a big... That would have been a great chance to cement Aberdeen. But okay, it's come around again. Maybe a little, you know, two or three finals later than we'd have hoped. But, you know, I think it would be... this is the time now to try and take advantage of this. And if not, you know, why not win it? But if not, then okay, be in the Scottish Cup final and that should be the benchmark. You know, winning a cup and finishing second should be, you know, the ambition for a season, and you know, then you try and achieve more if you can.
David, in your first season up here, you were obviously part of a squad that reached two cup finals. People look back at the league performances of that team and wonder quite how that was possible. But
I'll tell you how it was possible. It was because of Jim Leighton. That's why. That was the reason why we got two cup finals. I think I played the two early rounds of the League Cup, but
yeah.
I think Jim's performances later in the later rounds, that was the sole reason, really, we got to the cup finals. It was all down to him.
But my point would have been that even though we lost both games, they still act as a kind of energising focal point for the support, don't they? I mean, there were still 20,000 Aberdeen fans mobilised for both of those games, and people still look back at those occasions, not the outcomes necessarily, fairly favourably.
Oh yeah, I mean, that season, it masked over our season massively, really. Had we not made it to those two finals, it was probably one of the worst seasons ever for the club with regards to the league. But it sort of it masked over a lot of problems that we'd had on the pitch in the league, and gave Ebb more time to put things right. Which I think, I'm not sure, the next season, do we qualify for Europe the next season? I know it was up and down, but
two seasons later.
It was great for us, especially going to the finals. I know people say, oh, it makes you forget about the league, but they're not two different worlds. You know, you're still going into those games off the back of bad defeats or bad performances as well. You know, so it's, but you're right. It did mask over a lot of problems that we had at the time.
But equally, and you'd moved on from the club before the worst of these defeats happened, but Jimmy Calderwood really was blighted by his failures in the Cup, wasn't he? So, I mean, Aberdeen have pretty much, apart from a very brief spell in the history, always been a club for whom the Cups are critical to a season.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you look at it now, we spoke about the work that Derek McInnes has done the last few seasons, and, you know, losing tonight... You know, you talk about a fans being too picky and expecting too much. I don't think so. You know, where the club is now is in a position, in a realistic position to challenge Celtic for the title. Yeah, we can expect to at least get in, you know, to semi-finals of Cups. I think that's not a too big an expectation for the club. But I think winning things at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. And I think for the Scottish Cup, which is obviously the bigger of the two, you know, that would be, if you want to win one of them, that would be one of them. That would be the one you'd want to win. This season, we're at a cup final now. You've got to aim high for everything. You've got to want to win everything. Of course, you have, but I think there's a massive chance to go and win the league this season. As the last two seasons, I think that's got to take priority over everything, really.
Well, tonight's game at Hamilton, we'd hoped that it would kind of fit into the narrative, basically, and a build-up to the big head-to-head on Saturday. However, defensive frailties evident on Sunday seemed to really exacerbate it again in that first half. I've just seen the footage of it, a slightly dubious penalty call against Anthony
O'Connor. Yeah, I've seen it. I don't think it's a penalty at all. It is very similar to the Lamella penalty for Tottenham. I think there's contact, he's put hands on him, but I don't think it's enough for him to go down, to be honest.
And David, it really seemed to unsettle Anthony O'Connor for the whole evening, frankly. How difficult is it as a player to let something like that go?
Well, I mean, just looking at that, I think, I don't know who it was, somebody seemed to say something after that gave the penalty away, sort of criticising him. I don't know if somebody's gone on to him and it's that that's unsettled him rather than the foul itself, because really, if he looks at the game, I don't think he would blame himself at all. It's difficult when something like that happens, but I think most of the time, especially for outfield players, it's much easier for them to move on because they're straight back in the action and they'll get a touch of the ball. You know, if I have to give away a penalty, I might not touch the ball for another 10 minutes, and then you've got those 10 minutes to sort of to think on that. So I think it's easy for you, for outfield players, but I think people pointing at the plastic, the 3G service or 4G service, what Hamilton play on as well. It's, I know Aberdeen haven't done badly there in the past, but it does change the way that you play. You know, the bounce of the ball. They say the bounce of the ball is truer on that pitch. Oh, I don't think that at all. We trained a lot when I was in Denmark. We trained through the winter on 3G pitches. Trained a lot in the last couple of years with Lincoln City. We trained on a 3G pitch, and the bounce of the ball, especially when the spin on the ball, it exaggerates it a lot, you know, and it changes the way that you pass the ball, and it's, in my mind, it's a definite advantage to the home side. I know it's not the same as the old Loftus Road and Kenilworth Road 3G plastic pitches, but it does affect it, the way that you play.
And just as an aside, can one plastic pitch, 3G, 4G, whatever pitch, be completely different to another one? Because it does seem that the pitch at Kilmarnock, for example, which we played in a couple of weeks, caused us absolutely zero problems.
There is. I mean, if you go back to when... No, they're all a lot different now, but when you go back to when Dunfermline had the trial, the two-year trial, about 2004, 3 or 4, that was sort of like... That was put down in patches. So when you passed the ball, you could see it bubble over the seams of all the patches. And it was, and that was like, I don't know, it was a bit like, what do they call it, the game show. Where it was almost like it wasn't football, it was like sort of like playing football with blindfold on, having to play football with big size boots. You know, it was a totally different game altogether. And playing football with clowns feet on or something like that. It was totally, I mean, most of us, at the time, most of us were playing like that anyway. But it was, it does, and it changes, I mean, because the, you know, they put the small rubber pieces in it. And a lot of the pitches, depending on how the player's gone, sometimes there's the slide and tackle, some of the rubber pieces can gather together. So that makes the ball grip more in that area of the pitch. And I know it's great. It's great financially for clubs lower down. I agree with having the 4G pitches sort of in, especially in the non-league, in the conference, and because, you know, games don't get called off or won't get called off, and affects them a lot more financially. And they can make money through the community as well on the night time. So I totally agree with that. But at that level, and even at European level, you know, the Russian sides, I'm not a big fan of them at all.
Jonathan, we refuse to kind of use the referee tonight as an excuse, because you need to play. Referees do make mistakes everywhere in the world, and you need to play well enough to take that out of the equation. But down south, obviously, referees have been full time down there for what, 15 years maybe. Has that helped to improve the overall standard?
Oh, you know, it's yes, but I mean, the answer is yes, but not nearly as much as you'd expect.
Right.
What it's improved is a massive improvement in fitness. It's got a little better, but I think referees actually in England have maybe lost a little bit of personality. There seems to be a certain weakness about some of the ones now, where maybe it is because they're full time, they're in a kind of closeted world, and they're not, you know, they're not the referees who have full time jobs and live in the real world a little bit. You know, you get the impression sometimes they're just endlessly analysing performances, going to refereeing seminars, and, you know, sometimes just refereeing very much by numbers sometimes. The other thing I have to say is the game's becoming so quick in the Premier League that I think there maybe needs to be some kind of solution, because for the life of me, I don't know how a 40-year-old referee is supposed to run around. You know, you mentioned the Liverpool-Tottenham, Manchester City-Tottenham game this season. I don't know how on earth somebody's supposed to keep pace with that unless they are honed full-time, you know, 20, 22, 23-year-old athletes. So I think there's an issue there as well. But the fact that the best English referee is probably still Mark Clattenburg, and Mark Clattenburg's actually, you know, a great referee 95% of the time, but a horrendous one the other 5% of the time. But that's been the case. You know, there's nobody taking his crown for 5 or 6 years. Probably tells you that things aren't quite moving on as fast as they should. Not sure where Willie Collin would fit in, though, in the English refereeing hierarchy. I wonder.
That's an incredibly diplomatic answer, Jonathan. I'd kind of forgotten, of course, that your brother is within that system. So we'll move swiftly on.
Indeed.
Martin, tonight, start the second half did actually seem more positive, more encouraging. But then Derek did something which he is often accused of not doing. And he made pretty wholesale changes with a substantial period of the game to go. 3 substitutes after 65 minutes. And it really seemed to upset the rhythm of the side. I think there was a formation change there as well. You know, sometimes with the clamour for change, it might be coming from the terraces. Sometimes that can backfire, can't it?
Yeah, it obviously can. I mean, it certainly didn't work tonight. We seem to be getting into the game, and just as I thought, we're on top. You know, you see 3 changes happen. I'm never sad to see McGinn coming onto the field, to be honest, though. But it seems to be another game where Miles Storey's failed to impress. No, he's had a chance tonight, not really done much, fluffed a few chances. It looks like it's going to be disappointing for him. I don't think that I'm not a fan of this sort of, you know, 3 subs in the space of, you know, a couple of minutes, that thing. It's not something I've seen before. I know we've seen famous managers pull it in the past and somehow it's worked, but it's not something that's usually in Derek's repertoire, and I don't think it's something we'll see again very soon, to be honest.
Before the match tonight, Jonathan, Derek talked about his selection being a dilemma because he wanted to keep things fresh because he's got 3 games in 7 days, but also we're in the middle of a 6-game winning run. A lot of the feedback we've had tonight has been about, well, boiled down, why have a squad if you don't use it? Do you think there should have been more changes tonight?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's easy with hindsight, isn't it? But maybe Maddison could have been rested, given a mental break as well, such given his importance. And you know, why wasn't Ryan Jack brought in for a game like that, getting back up to match fitness and you know, a good head to sort of dig in on a difficult night. And I, you know, the squad's quite good now. That's one of the, you know, I was thinking about this watching, just thinking back to the last League Cup final, how thin it actually was when, you know, that awful minute that Johnny Hayes went off so early on. You kind of knew it was just going to be a really grim struggle for Aberdeen after that, and it's not like that anymore. You know, we've touched on the options, attacking options, younger players. So why not use it a little bit more? I don't know, with the substitutions, maybe Derek just got a little bit carried away with the changes that worked at the weekend and felt he was coming on old Mourinho, and possibly won't be doing it again.
One of the things about having that larger squad, David, is that it becomes harder and harder for the young players such as we have here to make that breakthrough. Now, we've spoken about this in past shows with other contributors, and obviously the players themselves have to be good enough to make that step. But the guy we brought in on loan, now obviously James Maddison is a step above Wes Burns, I think it's fair to say, in terms of the impact he's made. But is it right to be bringing in people on loan who are going to make bit part contributions rather than trying to bring on your own youngsters?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, really, because I mean, if you're bringing in players who are clearly going to, like you said about James Maddison, clearly going to improve the team, then I think if you get the opportunity to bring people like him, like Danny Ward last season, you've got to be very astute. And try and bring those, the ones you want to bring in. It's difficult. I mean, probably tonight, I know he made the change with McGinn, but it could be sort of victims of their own success, really, whereas, you know, you're on a six-game winning streak. You want to keep everything as much the same as possible. As long as people aren't carrying injuries and everyone's going to full confidence, especially at this stage of the season, actually, I'll change that. At any stage of the season now, really, with the fitness, the sports science at clubs, I don't buy players really being sort of so tired that they need a rest. Yeah. I think they're mentally, like Jonathan said earlier on, mentally probably, yes, James Maddison might be feeling a little bit jaded and the games might be taking his toll on because it's his first real spell of first team football. But I'd be quite happy if the team's playing well. And to me, if Derek making those three changes tonight, that's obviously a sign of probably how badly it was going on the pitch, rather than him trying to, you know, trying something spectacular. He's probably thinking, well, there's that much going wrong, I need to change three, and I need to change as much as I possibly can. And you know, obviously, it didn't work, it didn't go to plan, but like I said, I'd be quite happy for them just to keep playing the same 11 as long as they were getting results.
I mean, surely there's a limit, David, to that thinking with regards to tiredness, because now McGinn being the key example, having played pretty much non-stop.
Well, I mean, that's it. I mean, obviously, he's away with the Euros as well, and I think that it's probably maybe shown with Harry Kane a little bit when he's been, when he hasn't been scoring, I mean, that people point about he hasn't had a rest. But I think at the end of the day, if you're playing well, if you're a striker scoring goals, if you're a winger providing goals, those things, think you become less tired. It doesn't affect you as mentally as it would if you're in a relegation battle, if you're slogging it out down the bottom. I think, of course, if you know, it's a much stronger squad than in the past, and it has to be said that if you know, you have to monitor those players in training and in the reserve games, the under-23 games, you monitor them, and then if they're deserving of coming in, and you think it's not going to affect your team too much, or even if you think it's going to improve it, then of course you can change. But I think that's as much as making sure players aren't tired. Who have been playing the start 11, got to make sure that the ones that are in the stands or on the bench, they're ready. And maybe, you know, sometimes if you're not changing, maybe just because those players on the bench or on the fringes aren't doing enough in training and in bounce games to warrant a change.
Jonathan, I just want to continue on the tiredness thing, because something that again has been brought up tonight is that our last couple of seasons under Derek McInnes, we have really dramatically tailed off post-split, last half dozen games of a season. Is that because, in terms of a traditional winter calendar, with the starts that we've been had, we're kind of into unknown territory, really, by playing for effectively 11 months of the year?
Yeah, that's true. That is brutal. And when you're adding in the Euros into that with the case of Niall McGinn, it's pretty difficult. I think also, hopefully this will change with the way that Derek's trying to evolve the team, because one of the consequences, I think, of having a little bit more in terms of attacking options and outlets is actually that it should give the team, it should give players breathers at times, because it enables you to, obviously it enables you to win games a little bit more easily, score a little bit more easily. And at times, not this season, but over the last couple of seasons, you know, it did, even last season when there was that great run of wins, at times it did feel that every win had to be really, really sweated for, because, you know, apart from you know, Rooney scoring, at times there wasn't a lot to differentiate games. So that, hopefully, you know, there's younger players in the squad, as I say, there's more options, and that might just give players a breather over the season. But there's no getting away from the fact that when your first game's on the 14th of July or whatever it was, and that means that you've actually got to start sometime in June in terms of your pre-season. I mean, that's that. And then you've got to go through the winter calendar, and you don't have a huge amount of resources. That has got to be tough. Of course it's tough. And I think, you know, that's one area where we probably do have to be a little bit realistic and patient and realise that at the moment, Aberdeen aren't going to have the consistency of a Celtic with a great big squad and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That there are going to be times when, and, you know, there's going to be disappointing nights. You know, and I guess tonight was a classic example, after a pretty thick and fast run of fixtures, big game either side at the weekends in Glasgow. Then, you know, these things are going to happen, I guess.
Yeah, first game of the season, famously, of course, on the 30th of June, our first competitive game.
30th of June, was it? Gee, that's amazing.
So, as you just mentioned there, Jonathan, it's Celtic on Saturday. It's not quite going to be the two teams clashing in tip-top form that we'd hoped, thanks to our defeat tonight. Jonathan, obviously you would have seen a lot of Brendan Rodgers, both at Swansea, and more so probably at Liverpool, given your beat. First of all, were you quite surprised that he took the Celtic job?
No. Brendan was often accused of blarney, particularly towards the end of his time, but he is genuine about being a Celtic supporter. I talked to him about it when he was Liverpool manager. I remember having this, we got into this discussion about midfielders. He had a Sunday journalist briefing, there was about five or six of us, and he started talking about midfield players and started waxing about Paul McStay, you know, when you expect him to be talking about Xavi and Iniesta and so on. And he is a genuine Celtic fan. I mean, I don't think there's any getting away from the fact that ideally for him, he would still be in the upper echelons of the Premier League. You know, he rates himself highly enough and thinks that that's where he should be. And I think he would have taken a plum job in the Premier League had it come up. Unlike a lot of guys in his position, would see Celtic as a big job, you know. Because he has that family connection to the club. And the other reason I wasn't entirely surprised was he did get a hounding towards the end of his time. Yeah. Liverpool can be a really brutal club to fail at, partly because Liverpool managers do create such expectation. Liverpool fans do give their managers backing until the point where they decide they're not the Messiah, and then it goes completely the other way. And that happened to Brendan Rodgers, and he was a shadow of himself towards the end of his time. So I think getting away from England was probably an attraction as well. And then, you know, again, he does fancy himself as a Champions League manager, so I guess the European thing was an attraction there. I know, as I say, from knowing people around him, that the big sigh of relief for him was getting into the Champions League at the start of the season, qualifying. At that point, I think he thought, you know, he could relax and that his job was, you know, sort of half done as Celtic manager. And look, I think it's good. Obviously, it'd be great if Celtic were rubbish and had a bad manager, which, you know, we couldn't capitalise on that last year. But I actually think it's good for Scotland to have someone like Brendan Rodgers up there, not least because it does attract a bit more publicity from outside as well.
David, we were able last season in our home games against Celtic to specifically, I think, exploit the weaknesses they had at centre-half. This year they seem to have landed on a more regular centre-half pairing of Simonovic and Shevchenko. Pace appears to perhaps be the best way to hit them. But I'm also wondering about the dilemmas that Celtic have had in goal, opting, I think, in recent weeks to go back to Craig Gordon. What's your opinion on the goalkeeping situation and the defensive situation now at Celtic?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a bit of Shevchenko when he was at FC Michelin, and I generally thought he was a decent signing. I think given time, he'd become a good centre-half for them. And I think that, like you said, with the goalkeeping situation, I wasn't too surprised. I didn't think it was too harsh to drop Craig Gordon. I know that De Vries is a very capable goalkeeper. He's excellent in his feet. I saw him play a few times when he was at Swansea, obviously when Brendan was there. And he probably just needed, you know, like that. We've talked about this in the last couple of months with the mistakes the keepers have made when they first come into size and when they first move to clubs, and they need the familiarity and they need that 6-7 games that they know that they'll get before people start judging them, and more importantly before managers start judging them. And I think, you know, you look at Liverpool now with Loris Karius, he's been given that as well, and yeah, you know, there might be many managers who've sort of saw Karius and said, well, you know, he's not ready yet, and then pull him straight back out again instead of giving him his head. And I think that whether, you know, I know that Brendan kind of admitted that he made the wrong decision dropping Craig, and, you know, Craig's spent a lot of time out of football, and he's enjoyed a bit of an Indian summer because he's got a new lease of life. And I think that, like I said, at the time I probably was thinking he was right, but then again, if you go to make that decision, you probably still stuck with De Vries and give him a fair chance as well, you know. But I think there's definitely, I mean, the set pieces that are being put in now, especially with the delivery from Madison, they're very dangerous, and I think that could be a major threat. I think it's one big, in my eyes, it's probably one weakness that Craig's got that he's shown the last year or so. And I think it can definitely be, I think if anything's been got out of the game, it's going to be through the set piece, I think.
Martin, the last kind of showcase game at Pittodrie, the game against the Rangers, Derek ceded possession and a lot of territory to the visitors that day. Do you think we'll take such a passive approach on Saturday, or do you expect us to be a bit more up and at them?
I think we might be a little bit more up and at them. I mean, Celtic are defensively obviously a lot stronger than Rangers were, but I still think, and I've said this last season, I said this earlier in the season as well, that I still think that Celtic can be gotten at. You've obviously mentioned the goalkeepers there. Their centre-halves, I mean, you know, if you saw last week their European game, obviously Toure, you know, he's got a mistake in him if he plays. As good as he can be, he's got a mistake in him, and it's something we can possibly exploit. So I do think we'll possibly be a little bit more adventurous. That does, of course, open up for the little worry of, you know, the chance that, you know, defensively we aren't exactly, you know, watertight at the moment. as Wolves has discussed earlier. But I certainly do think we'll be just a tad more adventurous. Happy to let Rangers have plenty of the ball when they're up here, but I think if you let Celtic have lots and lots of the ball, they have far better attacking players that will punish you. So I wouldn't want to see us playing with no 7 or 8 men behind the ball at all times and allowing them to have guys like Sinclair just constant possession. No.
Well, that's Saturday at noon. We'll have a minute-by-minute for you at www.bytheminute.co. That'll be Jody Jameson that's covering that game for us on Saturday. Hope you can join him. So, just want to have a quick chat with Jonathan about his book on Leicester City. Leicester City, obviously, the big story of last season down in the Premiership. And within the space of about 6 weeks, Jonathan knocked up what is a tremendously brilliant read on the story. And, you know, everyone said it couldn't happen until it actually did happen. And the book's a real attempt, not just to tell the story, but try and explain it as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to do a couple of things in the book. One was just to try and give it that kind of momentum of the season, which was this incredible sort of ride that Leicester took themselves on, and momentum and stars aligning and all that sort of thing, sort of just gave them this great energy. And I suppose I tried to do that, and I tried to sort of look at some of the reasons behind it. I mean, I think in the book, I don't think there's one huge, you know, secret to Leicester, and I think that's actually the whole point, because you don't achieve what they achieved by, you know, just some sort of golden ticket. You achieve it by getting so many things right that enables you to beat the odds. And you know, they had a unique sort of culture at the club, not just the unity in the dressing room, but there was a real sort of buy-in behind the scenes with, you know, the head of recruitment was also the assistant manager, the head of sports science and head physio got to have a huge say in the training plans. The players themselves were trusted to have days off and had a sort of say in how things were run. There's a lot of kind of unity that you don't find in the bigger clubs that Leicester were able to take advantage of. And then just these incredible player stories all coming together at the same time to have, you know, individually probably the seasons of their lives, you know, aligning for a team to have the season of its lives. And that was great fun in the book, just trying to, you know, so many of them. Vardy was the one with the Hollywood film, but you could make a Hollywood film of Riyad Mahrez, you know, too skinny, too frail to be picked up by French scouts, living in a sort of French banlieue, they call them, you know, those kind of estates on the edge of Paris, unknown until 1920, Kante, far too small to be picked up. Someone like Wes Morgan, who was, you know, 15, he was released, he had to go and lose 2 stone, was playing at almost a sort of amateur level. You could go through the team and find these stories. And it was great trying to bring all those elements together. Already, you know, Leicester doing well in the Champions League, but already it does rather feel like that was something we'll be looking back on as a part of history, because it probably isn't going to happen again, I don't think.
Mahrez famously walked out in the trial at St Mirren as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because Mahrez did an interview in L'Équipe. I've got to be slightly careful what I say here, but he did an interview in L'Équipe where he kind of explained what happened at St Mirren. Now, the French libel laws and the British libel laws are slightly different. So he told a story about a certain agent.
Yes.
He actually calls him an English agent that ruined his time there. But actually, I know the agent, he was Scottish. But it's a very, very odd episode. Essentially, at the age of 16, with this incredible talent, I mean, he did have this incredible talent, but people just thought he was, you know, just wasn't going to make it because physically he wasn't right, and maybe he was too individual. But he was a French agent managed to get him over to St Mirren, and then he turned up and he scored some like 9 goals in 5 games for their under 21 team or their youth team, but he never even got near the first team, and found out later on that this agent had probably sabotaged his chances there. But I mean, he got you know, very depressed. Was living in some B&B in Paisley, some hotel or B&B in Paisley.
That would depress you.
Freezing. Well, exactly. You know, freezing cold. Scottish winter, Scottish food, and he basically ended up sort of sneaking out the back stairs of this hotel down a fire escape so the receptionist wouldn't see him, and then, you know, getting a bus to the airport and getting home before anyone could drag him back to Paisley. So it's incredible when you watch him to think that, you know, if somebody had actually noticed, somebody at St Mirren had actually noticed he was there and put him in the first team, that, I don't know, you know, he might have blazed a trail probably for about three games before somebody would have picked him up in England. But yeah, amazing story has won, actually. And as I say, they all were, really. So many of them.
Now, when we last had you on the podcast, it was in the week of a couple of key games, both in England and up here in Scotland, because back then we spoke about the Leicester story with you, actually. Probably before the book had been promoted to you, but Aberdeen had just beaten Celtic at home and reignited what looked like a genuine title race up here, and Leicester had gone down in injury time at Arsenal, but they really refused to fit the narrative that was going to be written for them, didn't they? And there's a big difference between the sort of underdog players that a budget like Leicester's will get you and the underdog players that a budget like Aberdeen's will get you.
That's true. That has to be said. I mean, you know, it is all relative, and Leicester's underdog players, underdogs in Premier League terms, but, you know, you're looking at a Danish international goalkeeper.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at a guy that had actually won the Premier League in Robert Huth, and, you know, a guy, you know, in Kante, although talking about him as a great kind of find, he did cost £6 million. So, there's a difference. I remember that conversation, and in a fit of optimism, I think I suggested Aberdeen could be the Scottish Leicester. And I mean, we've seen nearly any underdog team who does half well sort of being described as doing a Leicester. That happened at the Euros, but of course, these things only happen so rarely that actually only Leicester have ever really done a Leicester, as it were. And one thing that maybe people didn't notice about them. I probably didn't notice about them at the time until I really looked into them. You know, thinking about them losing that game against Arsenal and the situation they were in, facing a run-in, maybe the situation Aberdeen were in as well. The difference with Leicester is they were a team that over the previous 3 years had effectively won, you know, they'd effectively won three titles. Sorry, the previous 2 years, they'd effectively won two titles. They got promotion from the championship. You know, they'd gone through a run-in with huge expectation on them because they'd come so close before and hadn't done it, and they smashed it. And then the next season in the Premier League, you know, they were absolutely dead and buried, and then won 7 out of 9 games, which is effectively winning a title in a run-in, you know, doing it when you absolutely have to do it. And they actually were the team that emerged with the mental strength that nobody else did. You know, Tottenham and Arsenal, contenders, actually don't really have experience of winning titles, not recently. So in a way, Leicester, underdogs as they were, actually had an experience that the other teams didn't. And looking at the Aberdeen example, it's patently obvious that we don't have that experience, and nobody in the squad really does either. So maybe that was a difference, and maybe that's one area where Leicester could have been given a bit more credit than they did. They weren't just the naive, you know, happy-go-lucky underdogs. They were quite a bunch of battle-hardened players when you looked at it, who had a winning culture around them.
I mean, you're absolutely right to point out that there was a synergy to that side, and they were a proper team, but obviously there were some key players. And I want to bring in David here to speak about Kasper Schmeichel and goals. Can't quite remember whether Kasper's time up in Scotland at Falkirk overlapped with your own time in Scotland, David, but what were his key attributes that he brought to the Leicester side, and how did he dovetail with the likes of Huth and Morgan?
Well, I mean, initially, I mean, I didn't see him when he was at Falkirk, but I seen a lot of him when he was at Leeds, when I was at Barnsley, who played a lot of games when he was at Leeds and when he was at Leicester. And in that division, his distribution was a massive asset, getting attacks underway quickly. Got a huge kick on him. which he probably doesn't have to use as much in the Premier League. But I remember when he was at Leeds, he'd kick a ball directly in from a goal kick. He'd kick a ball directly in behind one of the full-backs for Jimmy and Beckford that won into, and it was a huge asset to him. But I know that he hates any comparisons to his dad, and I know that it's probably a well-trodden path. But if you look at the way that he used to play, especially when it comes to that the trademark Schmeichel star shape, you know, when he was coming up to block, he used to pull that so often. He'd pull that from a shot from 10 yards away. And it came to a situation where people were just waiting for him to do it, and then they just slide the ball past him. And he was losing a lot of goals that way, where nobody would ever blame him for it. But I'd always look and say, well, if he just stood up, he'd have a better chance to react. And it's that sort of stuff that he stopped doing now. And he's grown into more, he's not trying to impress anyone anymore. He's not trying to be this goalkeeper. He's not trying to step out of anyone's shadow. And no matter what he says, he was trying to make a name for himself, and he's trying to manufacture a lot of situations, where now he's just matured. He's dealing with situations when they arrive, rather than trying to be too proactive and trying to manufacture them. And I think he's become a lot better keeper for it. And a lot of that, with the Mike Stowell's worked on it with him in training, the goalkeeping coach there, or whether it's purely maturity and experience that's brought him to the position he's now. And he is definitely he's become the goalkeeper that everyone expected him to be now, or that the pressure on him to be, and he's certainly fulfilled that now.
Now, Jonathan, I know obviously by the closing stages of the season the book had been pitched to you, so you had a vested interest in them actually winning a league, but amongst the sports writers down there, was there really a kind of willingness to see them do it? Were they everybody's second team by that point?
I think they were. I mean, there was a, not really from sports writers, I did see a little bit of a backlash from, let's say, fans of big teams who just, I think, felt a jealousy and an embarrassment, but also maybe a sense that, hey, you know, the Premier League has got this inflated image of itself sometimes, and there was a certain snobbery about, you know, almost a discomfort about a team outside the elite winning it, that, oh, you know, a snobbery about it. But I mean, among sports writers, it was, you know, goodness me, if you couldn't enjoy writing that story, you couldn't enjoy anything, really. I mean, it was a gift for everybody, all these great human stories, something entirely different. You know, Ranieri himself, who's, I mean, he's a bit cheesy at times, to be quite honest, but he absolutely knows what he's doing in his press conferences. Always, you always came away with a line from one of his press conferences. You might then look at your notebook and realise that you hadn't actually said very much, but he'd given you a kind of back page with a sort of bit of quirky eccentricity. There was just something also very refreshing about how Leicester as a fan base and as a city kind of embraced it, because it's not, you know, there's no triumphalism. Leicester's a kind of fairly restrained East Coast place that we can probably recognise coming from where we do in terms of local character. And that was nice. That was something different to write about as well. But what did strike me was that the minute Leicester did win the title, then everybody started writing about Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola and big transfers and the big clubs. And there was maybe a sense among maybe newspaper editors that, okay, this story's done. It's time to move back to what actually sells papers. Because it's a sad fact of life that it is actually the big clubs that tend to sell papers. So we were all in writing the Leicester story, but maybe our editors were secretly willing Manchester United to do something spectacular, because sadly that is what sells papers. And there was one, I mean, typically it was the Daily Mail, but there was a Daily Mail backlash about, you know, some of the, when John Moss, those slightly eccentric penalties, the in the West Ham Leicester game. There were a few things about dirty Leicester and pushing and pulling and, you know, the dark side of the fairy story and all that kind of thing, which was a typical, you know, typical backlash journalism. But that was a small example. I guess the real backlash was, as I say, the fact that once Leicester won the title, it was back to transfer speculation, big clubs, you know, Jose Mourinho, blah 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 blah. It was certainly different while it lasted. Very different last year, writing about the Premier League.
Well, if you want to get the story on a one-off season in the English Premier League, Jonathan's book, Fearless, The Amazing Underdog Story of Leicester City, is out now, and the usual line about all good bookshops, etc. So that's tonight's show. Our huge thanks to David Priest. David, real pleasure.
Thank you very much, gents. Thanks for having me.
To Jonathan Northcroft. Thanks, Jonathan.
Oh, thanks very much, lads. Cheers.
And finally, to Mr. Martin Clunas. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you very much, Richard.
We'll be back next week looking back on the game against Celtic. Hope to see you then. Good night.